Good morning. How's everybody? Wonderful, wonderful. My name is Shane Austin. I'm the director of the Marriage Sustainers Program of Together Pittsburgh. And so I want to welcome you to our little real fast workshop. I guess that's what this is. And we're going to go over, I'm going to review some things with you that we do in our programming. But before we do that, you have a little brochure. Pull that out. This is just a brochure of Together Pittsburgh programming. Together Pittsburgh happens to be right next door. Our office is right across the grass over there. And so I just had to load up my stuff and pull it over from the office this morning. But it's a joy and a pleasure to be here with you this morning. I'm the director of one of the programs called the Marriage Sustainers Program. But before we get into that, I want to share with you just some of the programs that Together Pittsburgh does. We do marriage preparation. We have classes that are designed to teach couples what to expect when they get married. How many in here, when you were in high school, took Relationship 101? That's what I usually get. I usually get some laughs. Why? Because who teaches it? So where do we learn about the relationships from? Our family, TV, our friends, and we all come from perfect families, right? Okay, repentance tomorrow morning. All right. So anyway, marriage preparation is one of our programs, although singles go to this program even if they're not engaged or involved in a relationship. Why is that important? Because it helps them prepare and understand and get a better grip on who they are. Okay? Did you still want to...
I forgot.
Okay. Allison? Five other way around. Five grown children and four grandchildren. Thank you so much, Allison. I will send you the check tomorrow. Anyway, so marriage preparation is designed for singles and engaged couples. Then we have a marriage enrichment class, which is theoretically designed for couples who everything is going well and they just, we can make it better. And so they take that particular course. Marriage enrichment and marriage sustainers share some similar themes and topics, but marriage sustainers has some things that are very specific to that particular program, and I'll talk to you about that in a moment. Marriage enrichment has several different flavors to it. One is just for couples in general. One is for parents. Oftentimes, parents, while parenting, destroy or impact their marriage in a negative way. And so what one of the things that we teach them is how to stay married and parent your children, your wonderful little darlings who you've been blessed with. Then we also have marriage enrichment for blended families. You know, a couple has maybe been in a relationship before, been married before, they got divorced for one reason or another, and then they fall in love again. But now they got kids, and their spouse has kids. And they think that because they are in love with each other, the children are supposed to love each other. Well, it doesn't happen that way all the time. It takes time. And so we teach them how to stay married while your family is really becoming blended. Because more and more today, whether it's fortunate or unfortunate, that's the reality that we face in our culture. And then we also have a marriage mentoring program. This is a program that's designed to match couples with other couples, usually couples who have been involved in their relationship for a long period of time, married couples who have been involved for a long period of time, with perhaps younger couples who have not been involved so long, maybe 5, 6 years. I know some 10-year couples that need marriage mentoring, too, sometimes, and maybe some 20 ones, too. But anyway, it's a design. That program is a long-term program. It takes about 6 months, and although they can run it in shorter periods of time, and they go out on dates and they discuss issues, and they're guided in their discussion, issues that come up oftentimes in relationships. Then we have a program that we do in the high schools called Healthy Relationships for Teens. It's actually called ECHO. But anyway, that's a program designed to teach kids how to make good decisions regarding relationships. One quick story, one little girl was at one of the programs. She was talking about, she was a teenager, maybe 15 or 16, and all she wanted was a baby. She just wanted to have a baby. She went through this program and she came to the realization, she said, you know what, I don't want a baby, I'm not ready for it. But that meant that now she has to make some decisions, because there are little boys out there, maybe not so little. I skipped over sustaining relationships because that's the one I'm going to be talking the most about today. It's really called Marriage Sustainers, as you can see here on the thing. This is the booklet to the full program, which I'm going to I'll talk to you about and show you some slides from it. But anyway, Marriage Sustainers is designed for couples, probably most couples, even if your relationship is good, okay? Because the only couples that have no problems in their marriage relationship, just got married last week and last Saturday. I didn't hear no amens on that. I'm a preacher. I am a preacher, so you can say amen. No, the reality is when you take two people, male and female, with two different backgrounds, maybe two different cultures or two different families, and you put them under the same roof and say, we's married now, what happens? It's not always copacetic, is it? And so you have to work through some things. And where most couples get into trouble is working through those things. How do you work through those things? How do you work through what we call stumbling blocks? Every couple will face stumbling blocks. If you haven't faced them, keep living. You're sure to face them. There are some couples who have been married over a period of time. They have learned how to turn their stumbling blocks into what we call stepping stones. And they have a successful relationship, a successful marriage, and they go on and on and on and on. You know, one story goes, they asked a couple who'd been married, I think, 60 years, says, how'd you do it? And he said, I just listened to everything she said. But the reality, you can laugh, the reality is most are not like that. Because we have egos, we have wills, we have desires, we have needs, and oftentimes some of those things are not met. And so we struggle. And so we're going to talk about some concepts that today that lead people into difficult situations and how they can avoid them, as well as how you can work your way out of difficult relationships. One of the things, the emphasis about Marriage Sustainers, by the way, is a program that when I was hired by Family Guidance, I designed the program. And the reason why I designed the program was because at the age of 16, my parents got divorced. And when they got divorced, it felt like somebody just took me and ripped me in half. Which way do I go? I was in high school. I was playing football, and I wanted to stay and play football, but I wanted to stay with my dad, but I knew I needed my mom and my brother and sister. So I stayed with my dad and played football. But after football season, I realized it wasn't going to work. And so I wound up going. But the reality is that when couples break up in a marriage, particularly if they have children, you do damage to the children, whether you realize it or not. And the reality is, will they survive? Yes, they will survive. They may go through life crippled. It is as though you took them and pushed them out of the second story window of the home. Yes, they can survive that fall, but they can be crippled for life, okay? I made some decisions at the age of 16 and 17 because in my wise mind, which I thought I had at that time, like most teenagers, I thought I knew what my parents' problems were. And so I said, well, I can avoid that. And so I'm not going to have that in my problem. And I'm going to, you know, I made some decisions not to do this and to do that, not to do this and to do that. The only difficulty is when I got married, my wife hadn't made those decisions. She didn't know anything about it. She had her own set, her own dynamic from her own family, which was completely messed up. And at the age of 26, I found myself in a divorce court. And I was trying to figure out, well, what happened? I did everything I said I was going to do, you know. The problem is I made decisions on my own based on what I thought was right and not what was right for the relationship. So when my youngest daughter got married, I was sitting down talking to her and her intended at the time, and her mother, my ex-wife, was there. And her mother said, and this was the closest thing to an apology I ever heard from her, but that's a joke, but it's true. But she said to my daughter, she said, listen to your dad. She said, because had we had this information, we wouldn't have gone through some of the issues that we had gone through. And that was such a blessing to me. And that told me this worked. By the way, my parents, even though they divorced, stayed friends. And when my mother moved to one side of the city, my dad was soon to follow. And so he didn't live too far. He never lived too far away. When my mom passed, dad was just around the bend. you could walk to her house in a minute and a half. They stayed friends. And so I began to ask myself, if they stayed friends, why couldn't they stay married? You know, that's what a kid would ask. And I began to realize there were some basic, simple skills that they did not have, that they did not apply, that could have saved their marriage. Same thing in my own situation. By the way, my wife and I have now been married 24 years, my second wife. And so hopefully I learned a few things, you know. But and we still work things. We try to use these principles to work things through when we hit bumps in the road. Everybody hits bumps in the road. Okay, the key is how do you handle them? Okay, can you make the bump into a small molehill and be able to look back and say that was a learning point? And that's the goal of what Marriage Sustainers does. So I'm going to ask you real quickly to open to the first page of your book. By the way, this booklet is designed for a very short session. It's designed for a three-hour session, and I think we have how long? An hour? Something like that. So we're going to cram it in, but I've done it before. But we won't get through everything, but I want to give you a taste, and I'm also going to give you the heart of the Marriage Sustainers program. This is the one that we get the most feedback on, the most comments on, and I think couples get the most out of that particular concept, and I'll tell you about that. But real quickly, I want you to take 1 minute. You'll see on that first page, Marriage Soup. This is one of the exercises we do in our Marriage Sustainers program. The full Marriage Sustainers program is designed to be an 8-week program where we do one night a week or one day. Usually it's a couple hours for one day a week for 8 weeks. Then we shorten it. We have a version that we do in 4 weeks where we cover two sessions in one night. And that's instead of 2 hours, it's 3 hours. And we do it in three sessions. We found that couples don't want to sign up and commit to an 8-week program, but they'll commit to a 4-week program. But all of the time, it never fails, at the end of the 4 weeks, they say, we need more time. We want to do this longer. We want to keep going. I'm like, well, you know, if we could have got you to commit to 8 weeks, we could have done it. What the 8-week program does, it gives couples a chance to do their homework in between sessions. By the way, and I don't have these here because of the shortness of this program, but we give the couples, when we do a book, we give them the full manual. Each person gets a manual, and each couple gets two books that we give them. One of them is Willard Harley's book, Love Busters. Anybody ever heard of Love Busters? Never heard of that one, right? But I bet you've heard of this one, His Needs, Her Needs. How many have heard of His Needs, Her Needs? That was the first book in the sequel. Love Busters is the sequel to His Needs, Her Needs. I chose to use Love Busters because Love Busters summarizes the whole His Needs, Her Needs book in the very first chapter. Then the rest of it begins to deal with a concept that we're going to talk about called love busting. Okay, we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. And that's the one that really helps couples because, and you'll understand why in a few minutes, because they all of a sudden, the lights turn on and they say, wow, I had no idea I was doing this. You see, and they're usually not hard. They're things that we do without thinking about them. Anyway, we have couples do this exercise here called marriage soup. And you'll see a listing of about 20 items there. Those are the ingredients that we tell couples that they can put in their soup, okay, based on their ideal understanding or desire for their marriage, for their marriage. So you can have, but here's the caveat. You can only have a total of 6 cups in your recipe. Now, you can mix and match. We allow couples to use half cups, you know, and sometimes we allow them to use a little dash of this or a dash of that, you know, to do that. So, but it can only total up to 6 cups. What does that do? It forces couples to prioritize that which is important to them. Okay. And then so each couple, each person will fill it out, and then what they do is then we tell them, okay, exchange booklets with your spouse. And they all go, really? Yes. And they exchange booklets. And that's when we hear the laughter or the oh. Because what happens is sometimes spouses find out for the first time what's important to their spouse. Because they have not talked about it. And what this does is give them the opportunity, the means, a vehicle, so to speak, to speak about that which is very meaningful and important to them. You know. And we have some fun with this exercise because everybody starts laughing when they see it. You know, my wife put down one time, she put down 2 cups of sex. I said, you're lying to me. I said, you just put that down because you think that's what I want to hear. But anyway, but we get that kind of a thing. We get that kind of exchange and that kind of a banter. But we tell the couples, pay attention to what your spouse wrote down, because that's telling you something about what they want in the relationship, in the marriage. And the wise spouse takes that into account and says, I need to, you know, bring this into the thing. Then we have some fun about which ones do you think men pick the most and which ones do women pick the most. Look at some of those. I'm going to ask you this question right now. Which do you think women pick the most? Or which two? There's no wrong answers, by the way. Good listening. That comes up all the time. What else?
For
deep conversation. That's related to good listening. You're absolutely right. Time together comes up.
More understanding.
Usually, good listening, what did you say, deep? No, he said. You said more listening. He said deep conversation. And the gentleman back there said time together. Those three are the top. There's one other one that's the top one. No, that's not one of the top ones, generally speaking. Nope. Well, that does come up. But the one that comes up more often than the ones that we just mentioned are financial freedom. And along with that is stability and you know. In other words, they want to be provided for. And that's in our culture, that's generally the common things. Now there are exceptions to the rules. You know. For example, there is the occasional female that says sex is number one. And the men, we tell the men, do not tell us if that's your wife, because we hate you. So, but the reality is it does occur. How about for men? Sex is number one. Sex is number two. Sex is number three. For men. Why is that? Anybody want to take a guess? Football. Yes. You're exactly right. You're exactly right. She said, She thinks that's how men feel close to their wives. That's very true. The other thing is men are wired that way. Now, I make a joke out of it, and so don't get mad at me, y'all. But if it wasn't for sex, men probably would not put up with women, you know. See, we're real simple. Men are basically simple, you know. Eat, sleep, sex, and life is good. Women are more complex. And so we struggle to figure out the complexities. And that's what makes it difficult for us in the relationships, because we don't know, you know, when you're thinking a certain thing, you know, I want him to hug me. We don't know that. So, but if you say, I want you to hug me, we say, okay, I'll hug you. But we think that means sex. But the reality is it does not, because sex and affection are different. Women will use, according to Harley, women will use sex to get affection. But men use affection to get sex. It's the nature of the beast. You know, and we're not bad people. We're just males. And if you ever watch National Geographic or the Animal Channel, all those, males just do things to get sex. They do crazy dances. They do all kinds of stuff. Well, if we equate that to human existence, maybe some of us do crazy dances. I don't know. Anyway, so this is just one of the exercises that we get. This exercise, this section was titled Try a Little Tenderness. Now, by the way, this booklet is not designed in the order that we follow it. Let me just show you quickly. Is that up there? Did we lose it? We lost our image there. Let's see here. Did it come back? Okay. All right. This is the 8-week, the full booklet. The session one is titled, Why on Earth Did I Get Married? And we begin to look at the stumbling blocks in marriage, how what causes them, and how to get out of them. That's some of that I just shared with you, and I'll share some more with you in a minute. And then session two is Can We Find a Way? That's understanding the path to and out of marital difficulty. So, let me see here. Now, you don't have all of this in your booklet. But one of the things that we do is, in this particular session, we talk about the goal is to gain an understanding of how couples get in trouble. Okay? And this is where we talk about a couple of several concepts. One is the policy of radical honesty. And if you turn to page 4 at the bottom, you'll see it says, we sometimes tend to assume or think that our experiences and our feelings and that they're similar or the same as our partner's feelings and experiences. And therefore, they should understand. But they're not the same. And they don't understand unless you tell them. Okay? So, to avoid those assumptions, Harley says, and if you turn to the next page at the top of the page, Harley says that the policy of radical honesty requires that you reveal to your spouse as much information about yourself as you know, your thoughts, feelings, habits, likes, dislikes, personal history, daily activities, plans for the future. That rule helps couples gain a clear and accurate description of each other's thoughts and activities. Can you see where that's important? Now, some of that hopefully should have been done before you got married, especially with personal history. Why do you think personal history, particularly weaknesses and failures, is important for a couple to know about one another? Anybody? You tend to repeat them. Okay. So your partner can help you avoid. Okay. The other thing is, if you're prone to find yourself in a certain environment where you can experience a failure, maybe it's alcohol abuse or drug abuse of some type, and your partner doesn't know that he or she may lead you into that, not realizing that this is going to impact you negatively. You know, it may be going out to a bar. It may be going out to a club. I remember this was years ago when I was dating. Young lady wanted me to go to the bar with her, and I'm like, no, I don't go bars. I don't do bars. And she looked at me. She said, well, I'm just going to have a drink. I said, I understand that. And I said, and I have no problem with it. I just don't do that. So, but she didn't understand that, which is the reason why we never continued any further. But that's another story for another day. Anyway, so we talk about this policy of radical honesty. It comes up in a couple of other places throughout the full workshop. The policy of radical honesty is one of the foundational principles that we talk about, that we teach and employ. And it involves, there's four parts to radical honesty. One of them is emotional honesty. And you can write this in your booklet. Did everybody get a pencil? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't pass them out. Yeah. There's pens and pencils here. Can you get those, Allison? Okay. Emotional honesty says reveal your emotional reactions, both positive and negative, to the events of your life, particularly to your spouse's behavior. If your spouse does something that bothers you and you say nothing, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to do it again. They're going to do it again because they don't know it bothers you. And so you have to tell them, that bothers me, that disturbs me. What do a lot of people do? If you don't tell them, you will hold it inside, but it will still bother you. And when they do it again, it will bother you again, and you'll hold it inside. And there comes a time when that volcano that's raging in you, because you've been holding all this stuff in, can't hold it anymore, and you erupt. You explode. And your partner's sitting there looking at you like, what's the matter with you? You know. And it's because of our tendency to, if we hold stuff in, you can only hold it in so long, and pretty soon you're going to blow up about it. Thank you, Allison. You're going to blow up about it. But you can avoid that by simply telling them, this bothers me when you do such and such or so and so. It makes me feel this way or that way. Okay. You own the feelings. You let them know what the disturbing behavior is. Okay. And I'm going to give you another way to say that in a few minutes. But also historical honesty, that's personal honesty. That's reveal information about your personal history, especially events that demonstrate weakness or failure. Okay. When you open up about your weakness and failure, you're really opening up to your spouse, and you're becoming vulnerable to them. And that makes them feel more connected to you. And that's important because it says you trust them. Okay? And trust is something you always want to be building in your relationship. Current honesty. Reveal information about the events of your day. Provide your spouse with a calendar of your activities. And particularly with special emphasis on those that may affect your spouse. Okay? So, for example, today I told my wife, I won't be home till late tonight because I'm doing a workshop in McDonald, PA. So I'll be leaving here, going to the office, and I'll be at the office for a couple hours. And then I'll leave to go down to McDonald, and I probably won't get home till 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. So what does that mean? That means don't fix dinner for me because I'm going to eat dinner where I'm at. And she knows that because I've been doing this long enough. Then the last one is future honesty. This is important. Future honesty. Reveal your thoughts and plans regarding future activities and objectives or goals. Okay. In other words, when you're revealing these with your partner, your spouse, you are sharing your hopes, your dreams, and the goals for the two of you as a couple, and maybe even yourself. Okay. You're sharing those. And the important thing about sharing those is that now you get their input, and they feel like they're a part of what you're doing and what's going on. Oftentimes, particularly when it comes to finances, couples don't share. I can't tell you how many couples that I have dealt with, well, not couples, but where one of them has passed away. and as the minister or pastor, I go in to talk with them, and they have no idea what the finances are. Because one of them handled the finances, and they knew everything, and the other person doesn't know anything. That just happened last fall. A woman at my church, her husband suddenly died. He wasn't sick. Choked on a piece of gum, and she didn't know he was choking. Or a piece of candy, a gummy bear or something. He was sitting watching TV. She thought he'd fallen asleep. And he was without oxygen. Went in, wound up, she had to rush him to the hospital because she did realize something was wrong eventually, and she tried to wake him and couldn't wake him. And he was in a coma for probably a couple of weeks, and then he passed away. But she had no idea where that. She said he handled all the money. And she did not know. It's one of those things that happens. And so what we try to teach couples is everybody should be on the same page, at least know, even if only one of you handles the finances. You know, I often tell couples, whoever's the best one at it, let that one do it. You're not going to believe something, but 3 years ago, this is the honest to goodness truth. I was in California visiting my daughter and discovered that my ex-wife was separated from her husband. And so she began to tell me what was going on. And I said to her, I said, that's easily fixable. You guys can fix this. So I talked with her husband, and a great guy. I talked with him and told him. And I told him, I said, she's good at handling finances. You ought to let her do it. Because I realized he wasn't. You know. And I asked the Lord, I said, God, you got to be kidding me. I'm counseling my ex-wife and her husband. That can't. Something's wrong with that picture, Lord. But it happened. So, okay. All right. Now, here's the heart of the program. If you turn over to page 6. I think there was some. I'm rushing through this, so I do apologize. I skipped over communication. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Okay. What I want to talk to you about are these three concepts. The first one is the love bank. This is the concept that couples love the most. If I walked around and went to each of your bank accounts and deposited $100 in your bank account, how would you feel about me?
Love you.
He said he loved me. I appreciate that. Only got one, though, you know. But what if I did it the second day? And then the third day? And the fourth day? What if I deposited $100 in your bank account every day? How would you feel about me? And I didn't ask for anything in return. How would you feel about me? You say, he's a great guy. I could run for governor or president or whatever, right? But the reality is, I don't have that kind of money, so I'm not going to do that. But the point is, all of us have within us a love bank. Every one of us. And your love bank has an account for every single person you know. Your children, your relatives, your coworkers, and your spouse. Every single person you know has an account. When you meet somebody, an account is created in your love bank for that person. Okay? The love bank, what is it? The love bank is the way your emotions keep track of how other people treat you. Of how other people treat you. If people treat you bad, their balance in your love bank, in their account in your love bank goes down. The balance goes down. Because the love bank works on something called love units. Love units is the money of the love bank. Love units. And when people treat you badly, they are withdrawing love units from their account in your love bank. When people treat you good, they are depositing love units. When they do something that makes you feel great, they are depositing huge amounts of love units into their account in your love bank. And when they do something that makes you feel bad, they are withdrawing love units from their account in your love bank. Okay? So what does that mean? It means that the balances for all these people goes up and goes down, just like most of our checking accounts. Goes up, it goes down. Okay, we feel good when we are able to make deposits, right? We get the paycheck or whatever, we feel great. But when we got to pay the bills, I just got a hospital bill from UPMC for x-rays. It was $200-something. I'm like, that didn't make me feel good. So right now, I don't feel very good about UPMC. I think they charge too much. But anyway, when people do something that makes us feel great, their balance goes up. Why? Because they're depositing love units. They may not even be aware that that's what they're doing. But they're depositing love units, and all of a sudden we begin to feel good about them. And so when you feel good about somebody, you like to be around them. What happens when you don't feel good about somebody? You avoid them. You avoid them. You don't want to be around them. Why? Because they bring you down. They don't make you feel good. And who likes to stay depressed or feeling bad? Nobody. Nobody does. So with that coworker on your job, there's a reason why you don't want to be around them, because they're constantly withdrawing love units. Okay? But there are other coworkers or other people who are depositing love units all the time. Now, who's the person that's closest, that has the most ability to deposit or withdraw love units from their account in your love bank? Your spouse. Why? Because you're with them most of the time, you know. They can withdraw and they can deposit, okay? The problem is that that's where couples get into trouble, because oftentimes they're withdrawing love units, you know. Occasionally they're depositing them, you know. Guys, on Valentine's Day, when you bring the roses home or take the wife out to dinner or on a date or something, you know, you're depositing big love units, you know. But when you don't come home from work 5 nights in a row, you're withdrawing them. And you wonder why she's acting the way she's acting towards you. Well, your love bank balance has gone down. The love bank has two thresholds. There's a high threshold and there's a low threshold. When you cross the low threshold of your checking account, any checks you write do what? They bounce. Okay? We love to have our checking account at the high threshold, because there is no limit on that except what we can put into it. But the love bank balances work slightly different. In other words, it has a high threshold and a low threshold. When somebody is constantly pouring love units into their account in your love bank, their balance keeps going up and up and up, and it reaches that high threshold. What happens when it reaches the high threshold and crosses it? Come on, we're all adults in here. What happens? The person becomes irresistible to you. Irresistible. And I often say, and I know I'm in a church, but I'm a pastor, so I'm going to say it anyway. That's when clothes fall off. Okay, I'll put it that way. You become irresistible to that person. You want to get as close as you possibly can to them. The danger in that is that anybody can pour love units into your love bank. See? Let me jump to the other side for a moment. The low threshold, we often wonder where that is. Well, it's probably at different places for different people. But the low threshold is when somebody is constantly withdrawing love units, until there's no love units left. And what happens then? You leave? But there's a term that we don't like to use, particularly those of us in the church. It's called hate. That's when love turns to hate. That's just the practical reality. You can't stand being around that person. You will avoid them. Okay? And so, you can get away from that. What happens when your spouse withdraws love units and your love balance is down here, but that coworker at work is depositing love units? Infidelity. That's exactly right. Marriage vows are broken. Why? Because the person has become irresistible. Now, that's just the practical side to what God is talking about when he says, guard your heart. That's one of the things. Guard your heart. In other words, you've got to be careful about who you allow to pour love units into your account, their love bank account, into your love bank. Because it can happen to anybody, the best of them. And it can happen all because of this concept of love units and the love bank. Why? Because everybody has a need to be loved. Everyone. And if the spouse won't do it, I can guarantee you there's somebody out there who will find some way to do it. And so you got to guard your heart. You got to guard your heart. Now, it's one of the things that I tell pastors in churches that, you know, that especially churches where the pastor says, well, I don't want to, you know, they don't want this because they say, well, there's, you don't quote scripture and verse in here. I said, you don't need to quote scripture and verse to understand that it's there. Okay, it is there. I used to teach science in high school, and I would have the kids constantly asking me about creation, and I never once had to mention the Bible to get them to do it. See? But my principal told me, she said, well, if they ask, you can answer. And I said, great. Great. And so I took full advantage of that. Okay. So what happens? How do these love units withdrawn? Well, there is a concept called love busters. If you turn to the next page, so it's part of this. It goes part and parcel with what we just were talking about. The concept of love busters. Here's the definition of a love buster. A love buster or love busters are the repeated behaviors of one spouse that makes the other spouse unhappy. The repeated behaviors of one spouse that makes the other spouse unhappy. These are what we call relational mistakes. But the relational mistakes are not just a one-time thing. They have become habits. They have become habitual. Okay? So, they become habits in the way that we relate to our spouse, and thus they withdraw huge amounts of love units from our account in our spouse's love bank. Okay? Those behaviors generally fall into six categories, and I have them listed for you. I guess I should have turned my thing off here. The first one at the bottom here is selfish demands. Commanding your spouse to do things that would benefit you, there's a typo there, benefit you at your spouse's expense with the implied threat of punishment if refused. Selfish demands, where one spouse is constantly demanding something from the other spouse. Okay. Can you see where that would become a problem, especially if it's a habit? Let me just say this. All of us have occasionally operated one or more of these love busters, and we may still do it occasionally. The problem is, if it becomes a habit, it's going to hurt your relationship. Okay, let's look at number two. Disrespectful judgments. These are attempts to straighten out your spouse's attitudes, beliefs, and behavior by trying to impose your way of thinking through lecture, ridicule, threats, or other forceful means. Now, I have a habit that I had to really work on to change. And it came from the fact that I teach. You know, I taught in high school, and I teach at the University of Pittsburgh as well. And so it's very easy for me to fall into lecture mode. You ask a question, you get a lecture. I get it honestly. My whole family does it. But anyway, but I had to, you know, curb that because my wife was feeling as if I was treating her like a child, she said. That was not my intention. But since she reacted that way and felt that way, says, I got to correct this, okay? So that I had to take that habit and change it. The way you change one habit, a bad habit, is to replace it with a good habit. Good habit, very good. All right, thirdly, angry outbursts. Deliberate attempts to hurt your spouse because of anger, usually in the form of verbal or physical attacks. It's an unfortunate reality where we live at today, but people often get physical with one another, and so it's a real problem there. So, angry outbursts also instills fear sometimes in spouses, but it drives a wedge. It withdraws love units. Okay. If it's a habit, okay, then saying I'm sorry doesn't really work anymore. Because the way when you find yourself operating in a love buster, the way to reverse it is to apologize and seek forgiveness. Okay, that will reverse it. That will deposit huge amounts of love units back in. Why? Because it says I realize I've hurt you and I didn't intend to do that, and it says I care about you enough that I don't want to see you hurt, and that it will always make your spouse feel good. But if it becomes a habit where you just do it all the time, then sorry becomes meaningless. Okay. Dishonesty, the state of not being truthful or, more often, deliberately deceptive about one's feelings, past experiences, present activities, and future plans. Marriage requires radical honesty. Okay? Then there's annoying habits. That's behavior that's repeated without much thought that bothers the other spouse. I'm going to leave that to your imagination. Okay. And then, of course, independent behavior. The conduct of one spouse that is conceived and executed as if the other spouse did not exist. How would that make you feel? You know, it's as if your spouse doesn't care. Now, there are some things where we don't care. You know, small things. But, you know, if you go out and buy guys, you know, the $12,000 motorcycle, Harley Davidson, and you haven't talked to your spouse about it, you can believe that's going to cause problems. I was doing a workshop one day with a couple, and I used that example of buying the motorcycle, and boy, I stepped on a landmine in that one. I had no idea. There was a couple that they were battling about that very issue. And I'm like, oh, and when I realized it, I'm like, oh, Lord, here we go. So what I was able to do was I just took a couple moments since I stepped on the landmine. I had to do some medical attention there. And so I said to him, because he was like, she don't want me to have it. And I want it, you know. I said, okay. So I turned to her and I said, tell him why you don't want him to have it. And she told him. She was concerned about his safety. You know, he didn't know that. He thought she just didn't want him to have it. She was concerned about his safety. And so he said, well, what if I wear a helmet? She said, if you wear the helmet, then I can go along with it. We solved the problem. Normally, I don't try to solve problems in workshops, but I had to do that one because everybody else was looking at me like, okay, you exploded this mine here. You know, what are you going to do? But marriage requires interdependent behavior. It doesn't mean that you're no longer an individual, but it means that you are dependent on your spouse and your spouse is dependent on you for some things. Okay? Now, we talk about this because there's another policy called the policy of enthusiastic agreement that we normally talk about also. An enthusiastic agreement, that policy says don't do anything unless your spouse enthusiastically agrees. Make no decisions, don't buy anything, don't do anything unless your spouse enthusiastically agrees. Now, what that means then is that what if your spouse disagrees and it's something you really want? You know, you want that 60-inch flat screen TV for the football game, you know, but your spouse disagrees with it, you know. Well, now you got to use what we call in marriage persuasive negotiation. Because you got to negotiate. And you got to be persuasive enough to win your spouse over. And if you cannot do that, you have a decision to make. What's more important? What you want, that 60-inch flat screen TV, or your relationship? Because if you buy that TV, you're not going to have no sex for quite a while. And that's just the light part of it. Because if that becomes a habit, you see, then your spouse is going to begin to think that you just don't care. Okay, and then when they think that, they cannot respond to you. It's impossible. Okay? There are three promises that we tell couples that they made when they got married. that are, and they're all related to this. The first one is the promise of care, C-A-R-E. That promise says, I care enough to meet your most important emotional needs. We'll talk about those in a little bit. The second one is the promise of time. That promise says, I will give you time with my undivided attention. I will give you time with my undivided attention to meet your most important emotional needs. Okay? And then the third one is the promise of protection. And all the guys stand up and beat their chest. Yeah, I'll defend my family. I'll defend my spouse. But that's not really what this is talking about. This is the promise of protection. It says, I will avoid being the cause of unhappiness for you. In other words, I will protect you from me, meaning my own selfish desires. I will protect you from me. You see? Any man that demonstrates that in his relationship with his wife will never have a problem with his wife relating to him. All things being equal, you know. One of the things that I often say is that when there is, and this is for, you know, I tell those who are leaders in churches that want to run these programs, if a couple has a mental or emotional disability, this program is not designed to help that. There are some other things that can be done, that need to be done to deal with that. But this is for couples who are generally, you know, within the spectrum of the average person. Okay. So, we tell them if you're falling short on keeping any of these promises, you should immediately admit it to your spouse and begin a committed effort to change. Because that will reverse the direction of your relationship. It will reverse the direction of your relationship. I want to jump to most important emotional needs. You've heard me mention that a couple of times now. And one of the things on the next page is our most important emotional needs. These are generally categorized. This is according to Harley as well as, his name just left my head. Chapman, Gary Chapman, thank you. And it's affection, honesty and openness, conversation, financial support, family commitment, admiration, sexual fulfillment, physical attractiveness, recreational companionship, and domestic support. Okay? These are considered emotional needs that individuals have. Now, people will prioritize them differently based on several things. It may be based on your personality. It's also going to be based on your gender, can be based on your gender. Men tend to prioritize certain of them, whereas women tend to prioritize certain other ones of them. Can you guess which one men tend to prioritize, generally speaking? Sexual fulfillment. Amen. How about women? What do you think women tend to prioritize? Honesty and openness. True. Affection. Financial support. It's interesting. Women tend to prioritize financial support. Men tend to prioritize domestic support. Okay. Which would explain why the former governor of California got involved with his housekeeper. You know, the unfortunate reality is there's examples for all this stuff all over the place, you know. Men also tend to physical attractiveness is important to men. Okay. Now, that's not just talking about looks, which is our culture is consumed with looks, but it's presentation as well. See, you can send a signal to the man, ladies. When you go to bed at night and you got your flannel nightgown on, he knows nothing's happening. Generally speaking, of course. All right. So now, what one of the things that we do, and here's one of the things that let me just say this too, it's a little different, because I'm assuming I'm talking to leaders in the churches or people who are involved in ministry. This is something that we would love to come and do in your church or your organization somewhere. Just come and run a workshop. And we try to have couples, a minimum of 6 to 8 couples. I've done it with as many as 50 couples. I did it at Covenant Church of Pittsburgh, and we had a whole huge place full of couples. It's a little different because that was an intensive. It was on a Friday and Saturday. And so when we do the intensives, the couples don't get a chance to digest the material in between the workshops. So it's kind of like trying to get a drink of water from a hydro fire hydrant. Thank you. He knew what I was talking about. If you ever try to take a drink of water from a fire, you're just going to get all wet. You might get a gulp of water, but you're going to get all wet. But it does help. It exposes them to information that's out there. But ideally, what we do during the workshop is we'll bring couples up. Those, we have them volunteer. We don't force anybody to do anything or say anything. But we have them come up, and they'll work through some of these exercises in front of the group. Particularly the communication exercise is usually a great one. Because I found often couples finally get the courage to tell their spouse something that they want to tell them. And we tell them, keep it clean. But they'll tell them something that they haven't told them before. And we don't try to solve the issue. What we try to do is make sure the other spouse heard. And so we ask them, did you hear? What did you hear? You know. And then we ask the group, did you hear? And we go through the various types of communication with we skip. This may be a good place to jump back before. Let me finish these emotional needs first. So the key is everybody has emotional needs. For some people, good communication is one of those needs. Okay? One of the things that I like that's meaningful to me is what I call deep conversation. I actually love deep, meaningful conversation. And I didn't even realize that for a while, but a friend of mine told me, he says, you love to engage in deep conversation. I'm like, you're right, I do. I enjoy that. And so if my wife starts chattering about something that I could care less about, it's hard for me to engage in it. You know, she watches one of those programs, Tiny Houses, you know, and she just loves it. We went to, last weekend, we drove over to Lima, Ohio to celebrate, it was a surprise anniversary party for a friend of mine who'd been married for 46 years. And so we drove over there, and she's on the road, and she's just looking for tiny houses. And she says, I don't see these tiny houses. And I'm like, huh? She said, there's no tiny houses. I said, who's going to spend $50,000 for a little box? You know? But people do, you know. Like, no, me. Where I grew up, I was crowded enough. No, I want a house with space. But she just likes talking about that kind of stuff. She likes buying stuff that's little. You know, she'll buy something simply because it's little. She says, isn't this cute? And I just look at her, I'm like, if you say so. Really? You know. Anyway, I always tell her, don't ever ask me, do I look fat in this dress? Because I'm not going to answer it. Guys get themselves in trouble. Okay, before we do love speak, oh, yeah, how much time do we have? Are we done? Okay, you have a green sheet in front of you. I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, just fill out, all I need is your name and address. I won't dump a whole bunch of email or anything on there. If you want to put your email address, you can. You can fill out anything on there that you feel comfortable. If you don't feel comfortable, don't worry about it. We don't really need it. I just want to document who was here so that I know and I can go over and talk about that. And while you're doing that, I'm going to just share a couple of things about what we call Love Speak, which is another topic that we go over in our workshops. And we spend a lot more time on it. We have a little exercise that goes with it. But Love Speak is talking about the love languages, which is Gary Chapman again, I think it is, or is it Smalley? I can't remember which one. Chapman. One of them, I don't know. But anyway, I borrowed from him. And the love language concept is a concept that's very good. What he says is that we all have love languages that we speak and hear with. Okay? The problem for couples is they often speak different love languages. You know, it's like one couple, somebody's speaking German and another person speaking Spanish. And they have trouble understanding each other. How do you tell somebody you love them in German if they don't understand German? Well, you got to show them some kind of way. You can't speak them. Okay. Well, the love languages are a concept like that, except that they're not foreign languages. They're languages, although they may be foreign to some of us, but they're languages that that communicate love, communicate feelings, communicate languages that say, "I care very much about you." The first one of the five love languages, and he says there's five love languages. The first one is words of affirmation. Words of affirmation. Okay? Second one is quality time. And I'm going to leave the rest of this for you to read, because you can take these with you, of course. Quality time is the second one. Third one is receiving gifts. Okay? Receiving gifts. The fourth one is acts of service. Acts of service. And the fifth one, can anybody guess what it is? Physical touch. Physical touch. Okay? Physical touch. Now, all of these love languages are important. And we probably tend to use them all at some point or another. But for some of us, they're dominating. And what I mean by that is that, and we all usually, chances are we have two love languages. One by which we communicate love. In other words, we can tell someone we love them without using those words by using one of these love languages. And that there's a predominant way we tend to do that. But at the same time, there may be a completely different way that we receive love, where we know that somebody cares about us. Okay. So for me, personally, the way I receive love, the way I know I'm being loved, is physical touch. Okay? Now, it's not just sex. Physical touch for me, so if my boss comes up to me and puts his hand on my shoulder and says, "Shane, you did a really excellent job. That was a great job." It just communicates love to me. Okay? In a healthy way, of course. It communicates love to me. A handshake, a good, strong, firm handshake, says, "I'm really glad to meet you," you know. See? It communicates love to me. Now, the way I give love or demonstrate love is acts of service. That's just big for me. I'll do anything, you know. Of course, my job takes advantage of that because they got me fixing computers and all kinds of stuff, you know. I was hired to be the marriage director. I'm an IT manager as well, you know. And now I'm the photographer over there, too. So I do all of that. But I love it. I love it. For me, it says I care. I care. Okay? And it's one of the ways. So you can see how important it would be for my spouse to know that when I do something for her, I'm telling her I love her. She needs to know that. Particularly if that's her love language. Okay? So the key here is for spouses to identify each other's love languages. That's one of the things. Now, can you imagine trying to be married and not having any idea of that? Most of us have no idea of it. You know, somehow we might have fallen into it and realized it, you know, and we learned it over time through a pattern of observation. But if you can take a couple and teach them these things, you can eliminate much of the difficulty that they will go through. Now, you won't eliminate all the difficulty, but when they go and they enter difficulty, they will discover that they can get through it by simply utilizing some of these skills, some of these techniques some of these principles. So I think we're out of time, and I apologize. I would love to have given you everything, but we would love to come do a workshop at your church or organization. It doesn't have to be a church. We do them anywhere and everywhere. I tell pastors all the time, I said, let us come in, do this practical thing, and then you take them and you do the Bible study on it. See, I could do the Bible study, but the government says, no, you're not supposed to do that. They'll say, okay, but I find ways to do it anyway. anybody have any questions?
I did a lousy job of introducing him, but I just want to say somebody once had to introduce Paul McCartney, and she said, this man needs no introduction. And I think after listening to Shane, he won't either.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody. Ron, good to see you again.